Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today in the shed is
Steve.
Today's episode is all about war games, the 1983 John Badham film, and not in the shed is Ty.
Hello, Cosmic Shed listeners. This is Ty. I'm sorry I can't actually be in the shed with Andrew and the guys, but I am presenting the UK premiere of Karate vs. Mafia tonight, as one is wont to do. So I'm providing this little introduction to War Games, the film, from a theatre. Right, well, to give you some background about the film, it was actually based on a script that was going around Hollywood in the early 80s called The Genius, which was where a young kind of professor meets a young man who he believes is the secret to saving the world. But then by this time, there was a growth in young hackers that was doing the rounds in the newspapers. So the studio retooled the script to make it for a young boy who's into computer hacking. They brought on Martin Brest, the director who's known as directing Beverly Hills Cop, but he was fired after 12 days. So they brought in British director John Badham, who was known for directing Saturday Night Fever, obviously a natural choice, Dracula and Short Circuit. So he would later team up with Ali Sheedy from War Games in Short Circuit again. Matthew Broderick, who many of you know as Ferris Bueller, here in this film is David Lightman. This is the anti-Bueller. He's into computers, and this is something he clearly references in Ferris Bueller when he kind of goes, "I wanted a car, but I got a computer." He's far too handsome to be a computer hacker. I don't know what they were thinking, but hey, it's Broderick. He's charming. The film was actually a really big success. It was made for $12 million and made $79 million at the US. There was even a sequel in 2008, went straight to video. It's rubbish. It's called War Games 2, The Dead Code, and it stars Matt Lantner from Timeless, which I highly recommend. It's on Netflix at the moment. That's a really good series. Keep an eye out when you're watching the film for a very young John Spencer from The West Wing, and also Michael Madsen from Reservoir Dogs. He's right there in the opening scene as one of the soldiers in the bunkers. I hope you guys all enjoy the film, and remember, the only winning move is not to play. See you guys later. Bye.
Is this the first time you watched it? Did you watch it ages ago and rewatch it?
I think I watched it years and years ago, but I didn't remember anything about it when I watched it this time around. So let's just assume that this was a first watch for me.
Okay, and did you enjoy it?
I did. I really liked it.
It's well worth going back to. I mean, it's dated. There's no doubt about it is dated, but it is a lot of fun to watch.
It was really well received at the time. Critic Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4. But you're right, it was very of its time.
One of the things that really stands out, I mean, it was written by Lawrence Lasker and Walter Parkes, essentially while they were still at university, basically.
That explains a lot.
Two computer nerds at university.
Okay.
Which means you get an awful lot of wonderful computer nerdery in the film, but it also means that the women characters are pretty awfully drawn out. They are just... I mean, Ali Sheedy's character, Jennifer, is just really awful. I mean, people just don't behave like that. The first time that she sees John Wood's character, Falcon, on the screen. Falcon on the screen, right? She says something that literally nobody has ever said ever in the history of time, apart from her in this film, which is that him? Wow, he's amazing looking. Which is a ridiculous thing to say in the first place, and also a ridiculous thing to say about him, because he's in no way is he amazing looking. He just looks like, well, John Wood.
Really. I mean, I'd get special, but you know what? Knowing that now, that really explains one of my interesting observations in that it jars with my experience of being a computer nerd in the 80s and 90s in that a cute girl fancies a hacker.
Did they not fancy you, Steve?
No comment.
Well, if you look like Matthew Broderick, then they probably would have done, wouldn't they? He's not, as Ty said, he's not, you know, he's not a classic computer nerd. The other thing that I'm started on the negative stuff, really, but I wanted to just get them out of the way. The other thing that I didn't like was the music, at least at times, particularly at the end of the film, where, no spoilers, but, you know, it's the end of the film. It's a massive climax. It's to do with nuclear war, this film. The soundtrack is, it sounds like something out of Manon des Sources. It's sort of harmonicas and all lilting melodies. It's really, really odd. It's so different to what you would expect from a kind of science fiction techie soundtrack. And I just don't think it works enough. It took me out of the film too many times.
I've got to say, I didn't notice the soundtrack until the ending, which was incredibly incongruous, I'll agree.
Yeah. But those things aside, I love pretty much everything about it. I think it's an incredibly gripping film. Goes along at a pretty good rate.
Yeah, and again, thinking about how it would have been received at the time, it was a pretty high-tech...
Yeah.
Well, sci-fi movie, I guess.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think they won awards for the design of Whopper, the computer. Going, no, but looking back at it now, it looks like a computer. You would expect a computer to look at that time. But actually, computers didn't look like that then. And they created that kind of the flashing lights with LEDs and stuff. And LCDs, I think, and LEDs. I don't know which ones they were. And it was really groundbreaking in terms of special effects and set building at the time of computers.
Probably used filament lamps back then.
These computers give us instant access to the state of the world. Troop movements, Soviet missile tests, shifting weather patterns. It all flows into this room and then into what we call the Whopper computer.
Whopper, what is that?
It's a war operation plan response. This is Mr. Richter. Paul, would you like to tell these gentlemen about the Whopper?
Well, the Whopper spends all its time thinking about World War III. 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it plays an endless series of war games using all available information on the state of the world. The Whopper has already fought World War III as a game, time and time again.
Matthew Broderick's character is a fairly realistic representation of a computer enthusiast of the time. The technique that he uses to scan through phone numbers and find out which have computers on the other end, war dialing, is realistic. And in fact, I think the film was credited with a massive surge in purchases of modems and people engaging in that sort of thing, accessing BBSs, old bulletin boards.
That's
that sort
right.
Of thing.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And war dialing is named after the film. So that technique of plugging a computer into a telephone and ringing all the different numbers in the directory until you find one or several that are computer modems is now called war dialing. Before the film, it was a little known technique just done by computer hackers like the kids at the university where the two writers were at. And back then, it was called demon dialing. And as a result of the film War Games, it got changed to war dialing. I like that. In the 80s, there were some kids at my school who got hauled out of school because they hacked into the government computers. And I thought, how on earth is that real? That can't be true. And then I watched this film recently, War Games, looked into war dialing and realised that that was around the time of this. And clearly they had probably been inspired by War Games back in the 80s and hack into the computers of the government right here in the UK, and they got hauled out of school for it.
I mean, it was probably something similar to what they do in this film.
Yeah, probably.
In terms of the sort of military level hardware, I'd like to think that it's unrealistic having an internet connected computer controlling the entire US nuclear arsenal, and the whole pulling the wool over the military's eyes with the non-independent verification of these missiles. But to be honest, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because it's like, I was making a film about nuclear waste recently. And one of the things I found out about when I was doing that film is that the computers at nuclear plants are not hooked up to the internet.
They call it air-gapped. It's there's ways around that though. There's if you're trying to get into an air-gapped network, and I'm not giving away any secrets here. A lot of it's about social engineering. So, for example, there's tales of people deliberately leaving USB sticks in car parks, and someone that works in that building goes and picks it up and plugs it into their computer to find out whose it is.
Yeah.
And then you've got your virus. I think there were some reports of. That's how the NSA or whoever it was got a virus in to destroy some Iranian centrifuges or something in a nuclear refinement.
I think one of my favourite stories about war games is the Ronald Reagan story. When he was president of America, this film came out. He watched the film and he became quite worried by it. A few days later, he had a meeting with Congress, gathered them all together for a security meeting, and proceeded to tell them all about war games. So he gave them a synopsis of what happens in war games. All the congressmen, I assume they're all men in the 80s, were sitting around, rolling their eyes, thinking, what on earth is this senile old fool doing now? Eventually, Reagan turns to his chief of staff and says, is that possible? Are our computers vulnerable to hacking from enemy states? And they all look around the room. Nobody knows the answer. They go away and they come back a week later and they've got a full answer. And the reason that they've got a full answer a week later is because the congressman, the chief of staff, the security people don't know about this, but the computer scientists know about this since the 1960s and have been trying to warn the government about it since then. In fact, in 1967, an engineer called Willis Ware wrote a paper called Security and Privacy in Computer Systems, warning about this very thing, this very possibility. And Ware spoke to the writers of this film before they wrote it, and that's how they got this film so spot on about what could actually happen. Now, what astonishes me about that is that Reagan and his people then went away and beefed up internet security, which is something that is still going on today. Politicians still are going, okay, well, the thing we need to do is beef up internet security, computer security. What he didn't do, and I think only a politician could watch war games and take away from it the message that beef up your internet security, rather than taking away the message of the futility of nuclear war.
How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game, Marshall?
Obviously, one of the key parts of the plot is this threat of nuclear war. And there's been a real threat of missiles landing. Well, was it a real threat? In Hawaii recently. Steve, can you tell us about that?
On January the 13th, 2018, false ballistic missile alert was issued by the emergency alert system in Hawaii. It said, and this went to everybody's smartphones and activated alerts on the television stations as well, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii, seek immediate shelter, this is not a drill.
Right.
So,
can I stop you there for a sec? Is that something that's just set up in Hawaii, or do we have that here? Would that happen here if this was going to happen?
I don't know what we have in the UK. I know that the emergency alert phone system's used more in the US. They do yellow alerts when there's child abductions, and they send out number plates and things like that. I was woken up in the middle of the night in California a few years back by my phone making a very loud beeping noise. So I proceeded to turn that off.
What was it warning you about?
They send out number plates that the police are trying to look for and hope that someone picks it up and calls it in.
And it literally goes to everybody's phone, or can you turn it off?
Yeah, I think so. So the yellow alerts, I think you can say, I don't want to receive those.
Yeah.
But obviously, I imagine there's success stories of that being useful because of the critical mass of people that get it.
Yeah. And a black alert is where everyone has to go into a spaceship and get warped to another part of the galaxy.
That's the one that happens. That you know, it's built into every smartphone these days. But anyway, so this, it was a false alarm. As far as we know, there were no ballistic missiles inbound to Hawaii at the time.
Okay.
obviously, given the current state of the world, and Hawaii being within North Korea's reported missile range, it seemed a realistic threat to people. Mm-hmm. Imagine, just after 8 o'clock in the morning, your phone beeps, your TV starts showing a message saying there is a nuclear missile inbound, it's going to land not very far from you, seek shelter, this is not a drill. What do you do? And people reacted understandably. There's reports of people barricading themselves in their bathrooms. The advice is to go to a room without any windows, run your bathtub so you've got some water, stock up on provisions, that sort of thing. I saw one video of a chap shoving his kids down a storm drain because it was the nearest shelter. Mm. And I wouldn't be surprised if some people who had prepared and built nuclear bunkers for whatever apocalypse might come.
Yeah.
I wonder if people are still down there.
yeah. Feeling quite smug.
Yeah. It'd be fun if they came out now, a month later, and found that we've put cars into space already. What it turned out to be was that the system that sends out these messages is tested on a regular basis. And the way they test the system is very similar to the way they actually send alerts out. And initially it sounded like a bit of a fat fingers yeah. error. Now more stuff's come out since then, and apparently there's more to it. But it poses interesting questions about people working with systems and the way those systems are designed. When people interface with systems, there's all sorts of potential, particularly safety-critical, mission-critical systems, there's all sorts of potential for things to go wrong. And it's important to carefully design those systems to minimise the probability of that. Mm-hmm. And I know a woman that knows about that. Professor Jan Noyes at the University of Bristol from the Department of Applied Psychology works on designing systems for humans to interface with. So Jan has worked with companies like Airbus, NASA, and the government's GCHQ to design the user interfaces for these systems. And obviously those organisations deal with safety, mission, national security, significant systems.
It's difficult for us because we're on the other side of the world, so it's difficult to know exactly what happened because it's quite likely that information's being withheld. From what the little bit that we can see, it seems that there were instructions that were quite similar, that there was one word which in effect was critical, and that was whether you were on the test phase or actually the operational phase. Now, this type of situation isn't, that particular situation is unique in terms of Hawaii, but a situation like that in terms of a poor design is not unique. And if you look around our world, we live in the built world, and everything in this world should be designed for us. The reality, of course, is that our world is not designed for us. Yes, it's someone indeed pressed the wrong button, and of course, the outcome was a lot of fear.
To put you on the spot, whose fault was it?
Well, we live in a blame society, so we have to have someone to blame. And actually, from a design point of view, it's quite convenient to have someone to blame. What will happen, I suspect, is that the person who will get the blame will be the person who last touched the system. So the person who actually pressed the button will quite likely be reprimanded, and it could be taken further and they lose their job. Now, what will happen then is there'll be a common belief that the system is safe again and that it won't happen again, because by removing the person who last touched the system, that's the sort of general feeling. If you look at the Herald of Free Enterprise that went down off Zeebrugge or March 1987, the people who should have closed the bow doors, the deckhand, it was that little group that got the blame. Of course, the reality is that it's not operating that at all, because all the failures, both the active failures, sort of that one to do with the button pressing, and latent failures that are sitting in the system are still there. Oh yeah, and it's a public perception. Mm. Yeah. Oh, it's all fine now. It won't happen again. Reality is, of course, it will happen. The other thing, if you're going to be very sceptical about it, is that it's a lot easier to remove the individual from the situation. It's a lot more expensive and a lot harder to retrofit aircraft, for example. So there is a sort of... it's convenient, it's cheap. The other thing to think about is there is a view, and it's not a new view, it was expressed first in the 1970s, that there is no such thing as a human error. It's a system-induced error. So it was the design of the system that led to that mistake. It wasn't the error made by the person per se that led to it.
I'm a bit confused by that, Steve, because it was the humans who designed the system. So it was human error to design the system badly, even if it was the system that was to blame, if you see what I mean.
Well, now you're just shifting blame, aren't you?
Hey, I don't believe that any system is totally secure.
If we were going to redesign that system from the ground up, is there any insight or advice that you'd want to give?
Well, psychologists have, they call it their toolkit, and they have a huge number of sort of principles of design that they would have been working with. So a very simple one is graceful degradation. So systems do not just fall over like that. You start building in a very simple one, which I guess is, if you read about it, is highly successful, is the undo button in Word. And we didn't used to have the undo button, but people use it over and over again. The other one is when you're about to reformat your hard disk, is the message, "Are you sure?" So what you do is you just build in another little circle of actions that you have to do. That would be it'd be fairly easy to do that. They should have been doing that. So the system then would have fallen over very slowly, as opposed to just gone bang and out goes the alert. If you've got a critical action, you should really have more than one person that can action it. So there could have been a backup somewhere with a second person or even a third person needed. There are very, very few situations where speed is of the essence. The one time that you don't have any time is if you've got a fire. But a lot of the time, you will have time. So if something goes wrong, you can teach people to do nothing, which is a bit counterintuitive, but sometimes doing nothing for a few moments is a good way forward. It may be that the person before they do it is trained to just do nothing, just think, is this actually the case? Mm. And I mean, we're also presupposing that there wasn't a nuclear threat and that we don't know.
Yeah, it could all be a giant cover-up. North Korea and the American Missile Defense System had an interaction.
Yeah. And you see, then this is why you'll never get to the bottom of it, basically.
Mm.
And then what they will do is make an scapegoat of the guy, the person who last touched the system. But a lot of these situations, you know, the classic near miss, you learn an awful lot from them. That information can be put to good use in the future.
Gentlemen, I wouldn't trust this overgrown pile of microchips any further than I could throw it.
What do you think you would do if you got that message? If you think you've got a missile's going to land on Bristol, you can't get away, you've got, what is it, a 30-minute warning?
20, 30 minutes, yeah.
20, 30 minutes. What do you do if you've got 20 or 30 minutes left alive?
That's a really good question. And I actually went through that process a few months back when I saw a YouTube video breaking news of NATO-Russia conflicts interrupts live TV in London. And it was a simulated hour-long broadcast of what BBC News would broadcast, starting off with sort of very light rumblings about some shots fired off the coast of Syria, culminating in images of tanks starting to roll across Europe, and then increasing escalations and warnings by experts, and then the sirens blaring, the emergency report system coming in saying nuclear missiles have been fired at the UK, everyone take shelter. And it seems like a really ridiculous escalation to happen from nothing within an hour, but everything in that simulated, put together from other clips of news footage, it seemed entirely plausible at the time, and it really upset me because I had no idea what I'd do.
Right.
Now, there are some nice deep basements under engineering at the University of Bristol, but none of them have got supplies in. I don't have any rooms without windows in my house. And I've got no idea what I'd do.
Yeah, it's a funny thing because it's a different scenario completely, but I'd always thought, before it happened to me, I'd always thought that if somebody broke into my house while I was in the house, I would hide under the bed. Somebody did. We were in bed upstairs in our house, and three people, smashed our front door in and came into our house. And actually, my reaction was completely the opposite, and I became... I'll tell you exactly what
happened. Were you fierce?
I was fierce, yeah. Exactly what happened was I made sure Jenny was okay. I flew down the stairs, two flights of stairs in this house there were, flew down the stairs and chased them out of the house, down the street, and then suddenly realised as I was chasing them down the street that A, I didn't have clothes on, and so of course they're going to run away, and B, I'd left Jenny on her own in the house. And at that point, I thought, I've got to go back. I can't just leave Jenny on her own. So I went home. Anyway, the point is, my reaction actually in this scenario was completely different to what I thought I would do. So I have no idea what I would do in this scenario.
Chase it down the street without your clothes on.
You can't chase it down the street without your clothes on. Maybe I'd take my clothes off. Who knows? And so it's impossible to know, I think, until you're actually in the scenario.
Mm. Yeah, I have no idea what I'd do as well. But it's got me thinking, and maybe it would be prudent to have some supplies under the stairs or something. But you go down that train of thought, and I start massively empathising with these preppers in America that have an arsenal of weapons and a year's worth of supply of food and nuclear bunkers and stuff in their gardens. And it's kind of a scary way to live, but also I can empathise with it, and maybe I should think about that.
Maybe, but this was a false alarm.
This was a false alarm. I'm a frequent browser of the website Reddit.
I know you are.
I send you links regularly.
Yeah.
There was a really interesting discussion on the Ask Me Anything, on the Ask Reddit subreddit. The question posed was, people who made an impulse decision when they found out Hawaii was going to be nuked, what did you do and do you regret it? And the answers ranged from the beautiful to the ridiculous. So there was one person who stayed in bed with their partner and browsed pictures of their favourite holidays. And I think that's
nice.
Lovely. If you don't know what to do, go out with good feelings. Mm-hmm. Someone told someone they loved them and got an I love you in return.
Nice.
And then there was some interesting aftermath from that. It wasn't a happy ending, I'm afraid.
Oh.
Why?
Tell me more.
Oh, well, it turned out that the person replied in the affirmative because they wanted them to die happy.
Aww.
Which is nice, but also a bit sad.
Yeah.
One chap told his wife that he'd been cheating on her. Oh, he wanted to get it off his chest before they died.
Well, I'm glad that's out in the open.
Yeah, great. The one that really makes me wonder is a chap reported that his co-worker ran into their boss's office jumped on the boss's desk, dropped his trousers and started doing something unspeakable.
But what did he start? I mean, you're going to have to say what it is. Because there's three things they could have done.
Well, it wasn't a number one or a number two.
Okay. So, right, my question with that is, did they really like the boss, the desk, or dislike the boss and the desk? What was the motivation behind that?
I've no idea. The closest I can come is that you want to go out doing something ridiculous, or, I don't know, you're proving you're an alpha male or something like that. I don't know.
That's so awful. I mean, if that's true, and I doubt it, but if it's true, that is so weird.
It's a bit of sort of Mad Max nihilism, maybe, I don't know. Another thing that I found on Reddit about this, which I find interesting, because you know I love data.
Yeah.
The website Pornhub has a blog, which doesn't have porn on it. It has insights about porn on it, mostly from the webmasters of the site, about their internet traffic. And they can tell who's browsing the website from what parts of the world, because data helps marketing, all of that sort of stuff. A few minutes after the alert went out, traffic from Hawaii dropped by 77%. And then when the all clear came in, it went up 48% above their normal expected level of traffic for that time of day.
Okay.
Now, I think, again, I can probably empathise with some of the people's feelings in that case. But the very interesting point is the 23% that stayed on the website throughout that.
Yeah.
Now, maybe their phones weren't working, or they were distracted.
Yeah.
Or maybe they were just like, damn it, I'm going to carry on. I'm going to go out like this.
Yeah. Again, I've got 20 or 30 minutes left. I don't think I'm going to watch porn. But again, I don't know what's going to happen.
Maybe you've got nothing better to do.
Yeah. There's always something better. I mean, 20 or 30 minutes, you can watch the start of Star Wars: A New Hope.
I'm not going to make an obvious comment about your arousal preferences.
Have you heard John Ronson's Butterfly Effect podcast?
No.
Okay, it's fascinating. Anyone who hasn't listened to John Ronson's Butterfly Effect podcast, do go and listen to it.
Well,
he looks into the effect of free porn on the internet, and it is fascinating.
That must be interesting. And I know you have great taste in podcasts, so I will check that one out.
Thank you very
Butterfly
much.
Effect.
Butterfly Effect, indeed.
Thumbs down. The only winning move is not to play.
The problem that I have in society, that we live in a society where it is still somehow structured, that the answer to the question, if millions of people have just been killed by a bomb, would you kill millions more people? The answer to that question in our society is apparently, yes, I would. Because when Jeremy Corbyn said, no, I wouldn't, he was pilloried a huge amount in the press and in public, on social media, for saying, no, I would not launch a nuclear missile in any circumstance. And effectively what he's saying is, there is no way that even if millions of people have died here, that the correct response is to kill millions more people, which is just the most sensible response, the only response. And obviously, it's more complicated than that. Obviously, it's a game of give and take and scaredy cat and who's not going to do it, and we're not going to do it because you're not going to do it. But as it says, the only way to win the game is not to play at all.
Yes and no, I think. I mean, we've seen from the Twitter sphere lately that politics in the modern world is just a... or whose button is biggest competition.
Right.
The whole concept of mutually assured destruction is primarily a psychological one. You're not going to hit me because I'm going to hit you just as hard, if not harder. And beyond that, it's madness. So there's actually no point in any of us having all of these weapons. We might as well just agree to lie about them and pretend, yeah? And that's I think that's where the sort of mismatch with Corbyn comes. Like, if we've got this and it's supposedly a deterrent, and some people might go with that, I'm sure there's some interesting papers behind it, you have to say yes, I'm going to launch that. Otherwise, the whole thing breaks down if they know you're not going to launch it.
Mm.
Now, what you say in that war game, or to get your voters, might not necessarily be the same as what you do. And I don't know if you know this, but there's a protocol with our nuclear submarines where if they lose contact in a sort of nuclear war situation, if they lose contact with the UK government to the point where they have to assume that the UK has been wiped off the map, there's a like long range, I think it's if they can't hear BBC worldwide on the long wave, and there's probably other secret protocols that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
In every nuclear submarine in our fleet, there's a safe, and only, I think, one or two people, the captain of the nuclear submarine, let's say, has a key to that safe. And in that safe is a letter from the Prime Minister. And one of the things the Prime Minister does when he or she takes office is write those letters to those submarine captains to tell them what to do if all is lost.
Okay.
I have no idea what's in the brain of our current and past Prime Ministers, yeah. But it would be so fascinating to see whether they said, yes, nuke the buggers, or no, go find yourselves an island and set up UK 2.0.
Yeah, or just show the world how to live better.
The war's gone. It's all been nuked.
Okay, well, don't set up UK 2.0, set up the world 2.0.
Yeah.
I
go forth and procreate.
Yeah. I feel like there's... It's just... I tell you what I mean, really. It's not that in the context of the question being asked, there are reasons to say yes. But the fact that the context exists where the correct answer to the question, would you kill millions of people, is yes, is utter madness and a sign to me that we need to reconstruct society to the point where that is never the correct answer.
After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defence system sucks.
But Steve, where were you talking to Professor Jan Noyes?
We were on an academic recruitment trip to some international schools in Southeast Asia. And I really enjoyed speaking to all the students and teachers out there. There was a lot of rushing around between schools, giving the same presentation 20 times in a row.
Right.
Not a lot of time for the schmoozing and sightseeing that everyone assumed that we'd been doing when we got back.
Yeah.
But it was a real privilege to be asked to go.
Yeah.
I particularly enjoyed meeting students at the two United World Colleges in Singapore.
Cool.
We had some great chats there.
Excellent. Well, I hope they're listening now, subscribers to the Cosmic Shed these days. And thank you so much to Steve and Professor Jan Noyes for taking time out from that trip to talk to us. What a fascinating person Jan is, and thank you so much for talking to us, Jan. Now, that alert in Hawaii was a false alarm. But there are people in Hawaii who are studying real threats to the whole planet. And one of them is Dave Tholen, who I spoke to. Dave is an astronomer based in Hawaii, and he studies near-Earth asteroids.
I'm mostly a solar system astronomer, so in recent years I've spent most of my time chasing asteroids around the sky. Well, the primary emphasis right now is on the so-called impact hazard, killer asteroids. We have a mandate from Congress to find these objects, determine their orbits well enough to rule out whether they represent a future impact threat to the Earth, and to do some characterization work to find out what they're like in the event that we do come across an object that we need to do something about it. We have enough information about what asteroids are like to make some educated guesses as to how to best deal with moving one of these objects.
So you would recommend moving it rather than blowing it up? Or I think I saw something about painting it white or something. If you paint one side of it white, doesn't that...
You would have to know how it spins in order for that method to be effective. If you paint just one side white and it's spinning, well, that kind of averages out the effect that you're trying to create. But if, you know, if you paint just the northern hemisphere white, then the fact that it's spinning doesn't really matter because it's the same hemisphere all the time. Or alternatively, the southern hemisphere. So, you know, if you paint it white on, you know, the hemisphere centered on a spin axis, then you can create a differential effect that could build up slowly over the long term. And that's the key in most mitigation methods, is having adequate time, lots of time. I mean, you'd ideally like to have decades of advance warning so that you can use a variety of techniques, each of which are very small in effect, but, you know, given enough time, even a small effect can build up and prevent a collision with an asteroid. So it's only in the more drastic cases would you consider blowing it up. And then, you know, all you're doing is distributing the energy over a much larger area. But it could be that the where you distribute the energy is much less harmful. I mean, having 1,000 impacts by objects, you know, only a meter in size, most of those will burn up in the atmosphere. And the biggest effect to the ground will be, you know, some meteorite fragments. That's a better scenario than having a large 100-meter size object landing in a single spot.
So when you're looking for these things, are you getting? Is it like a large sky survey? How are you looking for them? What's the techniques?
Well, University of Hawaii has a survey telescope at the summit of Haleakala called PanSARS. And they take 4 images of the same piece of sky about 15 to 20 minutes apart. They will take a picture of one piece of sky, move to the adjacent piece of sky, take a picture there, move to another adjacent piece of sky, and, you know, they'll do something on the order of a dozen adjacent fields, and then they go back and repeat those fields. So there's roughly 15, 20 minutes between exposures of the same piece of sky, and then you align all the images in the computer, basically subtract out all the objects that aren't moving. So stars and galaxies, they haven't moved appreciably in 15 or 20 minutes, and so you can subtract those out, and then anything that does move is going to leave the equivalent of a black-white pair in your image. And that's one way you can detect moving objects. And then you do the astrometry on those objects and try to compute a preliminary orbit and see if it is potentially of interest. Usually you distinguish the ones of interest by their motion in that particular part of the sky. If the motion is unusual in some way, it may indicate an object that's close to the Earth. That sweeps an awful lot of details under the rug.
Yeah.
You know, as the saying goes, the devil is in the details.
Yeah, for sure. But you've been doing it for a number of years. How many objects have you seen that you've thought, okay, that's a potential threat?
Okay, we need to make a distinction here between seeing an object that we think might be a near-Earth object versus seeing an object that we might think is a threat. Any near-Earth object is potentially threatening until you establish the orbit well enough to rule it out. But we don't actually do those calculations as a general rule. The folks at JPL have an automated monitoring program, and there's a similar system in place at the University of Pisa in Italy, and those two cross-check each other's work. To answer your question, I've been involved in the discovery of some dozens of objects, and we track thousands more. I mean, the PanSTARRS project is finding roughly 1,000 objects a year.
Is there a kind of protocol for it? You find something that is in looks like it's in an orbit which it will collide with Earth.
Well, when you find a moving object in your images, you compute a score, and if that score is higher than something like 50 on this arbitrary scale, that signifies that there's a good chance that it's a near-Earth object. And then the observations get submitted to an organization called the Minor Planet Center, which is based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they put it on a web page, which they call the NEOCP. It stands for Near-Earth Object Confirmation Page. Observers around the world will go to and see, okay, here's an object that's potentially interesting. It encourages additional observations. As new observations come in from other observatories, that improves the orbit. The observations will go to places like JPL and the University of Pisa, and they will run their impact monitoring software on the observations. And if it looks like the object could potentially run into the Earth, they will put it on their web pages as a so-called virtual impactor. What a virtual impactor is, it's basically an object that has an orbit solution that is compatible with the observations that produces an Earth impact at some point in the future, in the next 100 years. But that doesn't mean it will impact. It simply means that the uncertainty is large enough to where it includes the Earth in the uncertainty region. There's also a lot of space that does not include the Earth in the uncertainty region, which means it could just as easily miss. And in fact, impact probabilities are usually measured in like parts per million, very, very low odds. But we keep banging away, observing these objects that appear on the virtual impactor list until the orbit is well known well enough that we can shrink the uncertainty region in the future such that it's entirely off the Earth. And then it's removed from the virtual impactor list. So that's kind of the sequence of events. And JPL actually maintains a list of objects that have been removed and when they've been removed from the list. So you can sort of track the historical performance of these survey and follow-up efforts.
So is there anything that we should be worried about now?
Well, if you want to go look at the risk pages, yeah, there are objects on it. You know, the next time we're on the telescope, we will observe the ones that are observable and try and refine their orbits. You can also look at the page and see which objects have been removed recently. And that basically shows you that we've been busy tracking those objects and getting their orbits improved well enough to know that they're not going to hit. I've got my web browser open here. If I can pull it up on the screen without obscuring you too much, I can. Okay, for example, yesterday, 2018 BL1 was removed from the virtual impactor list on January 23rd, and that's an object we observed. 2017 UR51 was also removed on January 23rd, and we got observations of that one on January 22nd. 2018 AE3 also removed on January 23rd. We observed that one. On January 18th, they removed 2017 YZ1. We observed that one as well. That one actually briefly reached level 1 on the Torino scale, which means it was it had a slightly higher probability of impacting the Earth, and it was among the larger objects. So it's good to see that one removed from the list now. But if you go over to the object table, at the top of the list is 2017 XO2. It's got three potential impacts between the years 2057 and 2064. It's currently at level 1 on the Torino scale. It's the only one. And we also observed that one.
Okay.
So in this case, our observations improved the orbit to actually elevate it to Torino scale 1 rather than removing it from the list.
Okay, right. Well, listen, thank you very much for doing that. That's helpful stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of bonkers, isn't it? I didn't realise that there was a website you could go to where you can check asteroids that are going to come within our part of space.
I feel like I'm going to try and avoid spending any time on that because I'm already scared enough about Annihilation.
Don't be scared, Steve. It's okay. If it happens, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we've made some good podcasts.
Yeah, that's true.
That's what matters.
People will still be able to listen to them. Oh, no, they won't. anyway, Dave, Tholen and his colleagues are looking at out into space, looking for these asteroids which may collide with us and can do something about it. Like, for example, painting one side of it white, although Dave tells me that's not necessarily going to help that much.
This is all really important stuff. There's things within our control, like the politics of nuclear war, and there's things that should be within our control, like being able to see what's out there and do something about it. And it seems like things are moving towards a place where we're prioritising that more. And our friend Mr. Musk is working on backing us up on another planet.
Yep.
Again, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing is another podcast.
Yeah. No, it is. Time to wrap it up. There's probably a huge amount that could be said about War Games, but as I say, it's all been said. Just go and watch it and enjoy it. One thing you might not know about War Games is that there's a wonderful little game on your phone based on the film War Games. Lovely little puzzle game with a storyline in it. Lots and lots of fun. Download it. Very nice.
I'll do that now.
And thank you very much to Steve for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you so much to Dave Tholen and Jan Noyes for the interviews that they did with us and for the wonderful work that they're doing. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. It does seem a little bit like the answer for politicians is always, well, let's drop some more bombs. I mean, I don't know how many times we have to drop bombs on the Middle East before we realise it's not going to stop anything or change anything for the better. But they just keep thinking that's the solution.
I think I'm fairly firm in my belief that most of the individuals in the running of our country go about it with good intent, whether or not their sort of leanings are different to mine or yours.
Mm-hmm.
But when you put them all together in such a big system, being voted for by so many people in such a diverse group, it seems that everyone has to play games, and those games end up with unintended consequences. Thanks, Dave.